Hello everyone, I'm your host James Patton Rogers, this is Warfare, and I have some news. After an amazing 3 years and hundreds of episodes, the Warfare podcast is coming to an end. I always say it's a true joy to present this podcast. I've learnt so much over the years from our expert guests, but all good things must come to an end, and it's time for me to take a break from podcasting. I've just moved to the US to start a new job, and my wife and I are excitedly expecting a baby very soon. But of course, it won't be the last you hear from me. So now is the time, if you haven't already, to drop me a follow on Instagram at James Rogers History. This just leaves me to say a massive thank you to the excellent History Hit team for their hard work over the years, to Sophie, who started the podcast with me, to James and Dan, who commissioned it, to Steve, who runs all the podcasts at History Hit, to Aidan, who helps edit it, and to Elena and Annie, who basically run the entire show, working tirelessly to produce and edit the episodes that have allowed us to reach 180 countries worldwide. And of course, my final thanks goes to all of you. Thank you for your emails, for your support, for your suggestions, and it's been a pleasure to meet so many of you around the world in person. I hope you've enjoyed the podcast, and maybe like me, you've even learned a thing or two and discovered a new history along the way. I hope you'll join me on my next chapter. Enjoy our vast back catalogue. Enjoy all the other History Hit podcasts, and especially enjoy today's episode. Thank you all so much. This is the History Hit Warfare podcast. I'm your host, James Rogers. This one takes us right back to the start, to our beginning of this podcast. It brings us in to a focus on Napoleon and his greatest victory, the Battle of Austerlitz. To take us through this, we have one of the world's leading historians, Andrew Roberts, to talk us through this key moment in Napoleon's reign as emperor. Now, the battle took place this week on December 2nd, 1805. It was against the Russians and the Austrians in a deep, dark European winter. But this date, December 2nd, is a very special day that looms large in the calendar for those who worship Napoleon Bonaparte, because it's also the date just a year before, to the very day, that he crowned himself Emperor of France. So this battle was very much a testing of his mettle in the early days of his time as emperor. And here is Andrew Roberts to tell us all about it. Enjoy. Hi, Andrew. Thank you so much for coming on the History Hit Warfare podcast. How are you doing today?
Thanks very much indeed, James. That's very kind of you. I'm in the middle of a six-week tour of the United States and North America, plugging my biography of King George III at the moment. So it's great to have an opportunity to talk to you.
Ah, where are you talking to us from today on this tour of America?
I'm in Mexico today. Next week will be California. The week after that, New York.
I feel very sorry for you. That sounds like you're having a terrible time.
Well, it's very sunny, I have to admit.
as we're all sitting in Europe freezing, you'll be very pleased to know there is most definitely a cold snap that's turned. I've seen the first frost of the year this morning, so we all wish we were in Mexico.
Well, it's a good thing that we're talking about Austerlitz, actually, because the weather was quite important as far as that was concerned. It was a very cold night before Austerlitz, and I'm sure we'll get on to the weather later on.
I did have a question about the weather, actually, because, of course, we are approaching this anniversary of the Battle of Austerlitz, which took place on December 2nd, 1805. Would you say that this is one of Napoleon's greatest victories?
It was the greatest victory of Napoleon's in an entire career that spanned some 60 battles. I think it's generally recognised by most historians to have been the absolute ne plus ultra of battles for him.
The Battle of Austerlitz is the most splendid of all I have fought. I have fought 30 battles of the same sort, but none in which the victory was so decisive and so little in doubt. The infantry of the guard was not sent into action. The men were weeping with rage. Tonight, I am lying in a bed in the beautiful castle of Count Kornitz, and I have changed my shirt, which I hadn't done for a week past. I shall get 2 or 3 hours sleep. The Emperor of Germany sent Prince Liechtenstein to me this morning to ask for an interview. We may possibly get peace before long.
Well, set this up historically for us. How did Napoleon get to this point politically, where he was outnumbered and about to engage his 68,000 troops or so against almost 90,000 Russians and Austrians? Politically, how did he get to this point?
Well, he'd been crowned emperor exactly a year before, on the 2nd of December 1804. And the British government, under William Pitt the Younger, financed a massive third coalition against him, which was going to be paid for by Britain, but the lion's share of the armies were going to be provided by Austria and Russia. And by the August of 1805, it became clear that he had to do something about this. His ally, Bavaria, had been invaded that August, on the 13th of August. So he had to respond. He had all his army, majority of the Grande Armée, in and around Boulogne and on the Channel coast, up and down the Channel coast, threatening an invasion of Britain. So he had to act incredibly quickly and turn them all round and get them marching 600 miles to the Danube to take on the Austrian and Russian army that were invading Bavaria.
Okay, so this is a pretty key pivotal moment. He's got a long march on the go, and he's got to meet, well, it's called also called the Battle of the Three Emperors, isn't it? Because we know that Napoleon is one of these, but he's got to go and meet the other two. Napoleon, of course, this pivoting, splitting, tactical whiz with a military background at least. But who are the other two that he's facing?
Well, he's got Tsar Alexander the First of Russia, and he's also got the Emperor, Kaiser as it's known, Francis of Austria. So these three emperors do turn up on the battlefield. But even before the battle, in fact, long before the battle, Napoleon has pulled off an extraordinary coup in managing, through the use of the corps system, to get his army 600 miles to the Danube anyway, along all the roads that he mapped out, to according to dates that he set out right at the beginning of the campaign, on the news that Bavaria had been invaded, in fact. And it was one of the most extraordinary campaigns as far as he was concerned, because of this incredibly good staff work by him, but also by his chief of staff, Alexandre Berthier. And this corps system is an extraordinary system which entirely revolutionizes warfare. In fact, his greatest contribution to the history of warfare was his use of the corps system, which continues, really. First of all, it was adopted by all the other armies in Europe by 1812, and then it stays in existence until 1945. And what it consists of, essentially, is to split his army up into mini-armies, a series of corps which had their own artillery, cavalry and infantry, but also their own staff work, their own intelligence, their own victualling departments, their own medical departments and so on. And so they could act as mini-armies. And as mini-armies, they could engage the enemy. They were all within one day's march of one another. So one could engage the enemy as the others started to envelop the enemy. And this is what happened at the beginning of the Austerlitz campaign at the Bavarian city of Ulm, which had been captured by the Austrians. And the general Mack, who was in charge of the Austrians in Ulm, was forced to surrender with some 30,000 of his men, because he had been completely surrounded. And the question is, of course, why weren't the Russians closer? Was it just bad staff work? Or, as some historians have suggested, was it the 11-day gap between the Julian and the Gregorian calendars, which meant that the Russians actually were 11 days behind where they should be? It's an intriguing question.
So was it Napoleon's speed, the speed of his corps, which meant that he was able to catch the enemy perhaps a little bit quicker than they thought they'd be caught?
An awful lot quicker, yes. And he had 170,000 troops at this stage bearing down on Ulm. And of course, some of his greatest commanders were the corps commanders, people like Bernadotte and Marmont, Murat, Ney, Davout, Lannes. These were the Marshal Soult. These were the marshals who had only just been made marshals only a few months earlier. And they were keen to prove themselves. And across a 200-mile battlefront, they attacked and really routed the initial Austrian force at Ulm.
It is an incredible victory, but take us down into the strategic and tactical nitty-gritty. This is the History Hit Warfare podcast. These are the things that we want to know about. We want to know about terrain, tactics, territory, and how this leads through to victory. So, I don't know, where should we start? Should we start with the weather? Because you mentioned it from the very top. How does the weather start to affect preparations for this battle and how the battle plays out?
Well, the weather is cold. The lakes, there are two lakes in front of the Emperor's headquarters, by Emperor I mean Napoleon's headquarters, on the Zoltan, which is his sort of raised hillock that he is watching the battle from. And there are a couple of places where there are some important skirmishes going on, but otherwise, which he can't see, but otherwise he can see pretty much everything, insofar as anyone can see anything, because it was a very misty day. And the sun of Austerlitz, as it's famously referred to, is a key factor, because the sun comes up at about 9 o'clock in the morning and burns off all of the mist. And it's this mist that has prevented the Austrians and Russians from spotting where Napoleon has placed his troops. And he's placed them in a way, especially under Marshal Soult, where they can capture this high ground, a plateau called the Pratzen Heights, which are pretty much in the middle of the battlefield. And he's very good, Napoleon, in the course of this campaign, at tricking the enemy. He uses various ruses to try to make the enemy not appreciate where he is, but also to overestimate themselves and to consider that Napoleon is weak and pulling back. Whereas in fact, that's exactly what he wanted to do. He wanted to try to encourage them to take as many troops off the Pratzen Heights as possible, thereby weakening the centre. And there are lots of Napoleonic battlefields where he tries enveloping movements, he tries to attack on the right or the left flank. But in Austerlitz, it's a central thrust through the centre at Pratzen, which establishes his victory. It's interesting because the soldiers said up until the Battle of Austerlitz, and of course after Ulm had fallen, they'd taken Vienna and then they'd marched off into Bohemia. And they said that the emperor no longer needs our bayonets, he just needs our legs, because it was all a war of manoeuvre until the moment of Austerlitz. But on the 2nd of December 1805, he definitely needed their bayonets.
Step back in time with me, Tristan Hughes, on the Ancients from History Hit as we unearth Pompeii's buried secrets in a special mini-series. You'll discover what life was like in this town before the eruption of Vesuvius, the bustling streets, the roar of the gladiators, and the hidden lives of sex workers. Lost for over 1,500 years and then uncovered, Pompeii's saga continues. With the help of leading experts, we'll bust myths and reveal startling new research. So get ready for a dramatic journey through the echoes of the past. Experience Pompeii like never before on the Ancients from History Hit. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
So Napoleon manages to move his troops up the plateau at Pratzen, or does he manage to lull some of them down into a trap first?
It's both pretty much at the same time. By withdrawing on his left flank, he encouraged the coalition armies to come down off the Pratzen Heights to seemingly take advantage of this weakness. And on his right flank, he's fighting various skirmishes in villages that go backwards and forwards during the day and stay. And so nothing's really going on his right flank. And then comes the moment when the mists burnt off and suddenly some 16,000 of Soult's division come punching through the centre. Now, as you mentioned, you're right, the numbers are in the favour of the Austrians and Russians. They've got about 69,500 infantry, about 16,000 cavalry, and 237 guns, whereas Napoleon only has 50,000 infantry and roughly the same amount of cavalry, 15,000. He's got a few more guns, 282, but he uses them extremely well, as I'm sure we'll come on to later on in the talk.
Yes, well, tell us, how long does this battle last in total, first of all?
It's the whole day. There's the original fighting shortly after dawn on the right flank, but then it's not, as I say, until about 10 o'clock in the morning, so after the mist has cleared, that Soult attacks in the centre. And then it goes on. It's actually not one of the longest of the Napoleonic
battles. No, I was going to say, yeah.
It's only fought across about a 7 mile wide front. But the point is that, of course, days are very short in December. So you have the sun coming up all right, but it also goes down very early. And the other major point is that the success of the French in the centre means that the Russian and Austrians are broken and they quit the field. When they turn round and flee, they have to do, quite a few of them at least, have to do so across the frozen lakes. And Napoleon ordered his artillery batteries to fire at the ice of the lakes. And according to some accounts, you know, entire squadrons of cavalry and cannon, horse artillery and so on, goes crashing through the ice to destruction. When the lakes were recently, I say recently, over 10 years ago now, but nonetheless recently in historical terms, they were dredged. Actually, they found relatively few bits of the sort of paraphernalia that you'd expect if it had been a major aspect of the battle. But it was true that he did fire and smash the ice as they were retreating.
Well done, soldiers. In the Battle of Austerlitz, you have accomplished all I expected of your valour. You have crowned your eagles with immortal glory. An army of 100,000 men, commanded by the emperors of Russia and of Austria, has been dispersed or captured in less than 4 hours. What escaped your arms was drowned in the lakes. 40 flags, the standards of the Russian Imperial Guard, 120 guns, 20 generals, and more than 30,000 prisoners are the result of this eternally glorious battle.
What probably caused a lot more pain for the Austrians was the fact that although they had metal cuirasses at the front of their cavalrymen's protection, they didn't have any on the back. And so if you're chased by a lancer, you're in extreme danger by not having a back cuirass in the way that the French had both front and back cuirasses.
It's hard to prepare for retreat, isn't it?
Yes, nobody likes to do that. And yet, actually, retreat is, again and again, so important because that's how you counterattack. I remember my don at Cambridge, in my first tutorial there, said Professor Norman Stone, I'd said something that in history that had happened was inevitable. And he said, there's nothing inevitable in history. Never use the word inevitable in history, except for German counterattack. And that's so totally true. True of the First World War, true of the Second World War. And you can only counterattack if you have retreated. So the retreat is an essential part of warfare. I'm just publicising a book that I've written about the King George III. And the retreat of Washington in the initial stages, his Fabian strategy of retreating and only fighting battles when he was absolutely certain, or he thought he was certain of winning them, was the obvious sensible thing to do in the opening stages of a revolutionary war with an untrained continental army. So yes, you've got to be able to retreat properly. And Napoleon knew that as well. He was involved in several retreats before the famous retreat from Moscow.
Something that I believe Alan Brooke planned and trained for as well was retreat.
Yes, I know. It's almost as important a part of the military repertoire as advance. If it's done properly, it can be a devastating manoeuvre. And also, you know, you see a lot of what are essentially retreat by closing up lines and pockets and salients in both the First World War and the Second World War. You know, they look like retreats, but in fact, they're strengthening the line by making it more straight.
So I could talk about retreats all day. We could do a whole other podcast about the importance of retreat. But we've got to the point where Marshal Nicholas Soult has taken 20,000 infantry up the slopes. We've got a point where the battle is perhaps, you could say, largely won. And then you're talking about the artillery that's used to smash up the ice and to take the ground beneath, well, I suppose it's water, frozen water, from beneath the troops. Now, is that the only way in which the artillery is used to ensure victory here?
No. It breaks up the major lines of Austrian and Russian attackers. I mean, he was a gunner. He understood artillery probably better than any of the other two arms of his army. And he knew when to use canister and grape shot and when to use shot and where to position the guns. He was particularly good at making sure that they had arcs of fire that where they could be at their most devastating. You also, of course, one of the things that he used to do in most of his battles, and often, again, to devastating effect, was to hold back the Imperial Guard. His crack troops, the Imperial Guard, were held back at Austerlitz until such time as he could see where there was a moment of breakthrough. And then he would pour them in, which he did in Austerlitz, to enormous effect. Partly this was morale, because they had never been defeated, and they knew that, but so did their opponents. And partly this was just their extreme usefulness and their capacity. They were they were nicknamed the Immortals, which they liked because it sounded as though they would never die, but also some other elements in the army called them the Immortals because he used them so rarely. And instead put the regular soldiers in the front line. So there was a kind of slight ambiguity about that nickname.
Easy to be immortal when you rarely engage in battle, isn't it?
That was certainly the joke that was made against them, yes.
So we can say that this is a resounding victory for Napoleon, but not one without great casualties. How does Napoleon react to the wounded?
Very distressed all the way through his career that he feels this. He goes out of his way to make sure that Baron Larry and the medical teams get everything they need. He knows how important good treatment of the wounded, or as good treatment as possible in the context of early 19th century warfare, how good that is and how important that is for the morale of the troops. I've never subscribed to this theory that he was just a monster who didn't care about his troops. He did. But the trouble is that with the exigencies of basically the horrors of Napoleonic warfare with regard to the edged weaponry and the lead musket balls and what a grape shot could actually do to people, compared to the really very still basic medical abilities that the doctors had and practices that they used and drugs that they were able to use, basically it was brandy, meant that if you were wounded in the French Revolutionary or Napoleonic Wars, it was extremely bad news for you, especially if gangrene got in, which it did, you know, even up to the marshalate. There are plenty of marshals who died of that.
And how do we know this about Napoleon? How do we know about his feelings at this time? Are these things he's writing back in his letters to the Empress? Where do we get this information from?
Yeah, he's constantly writing to the Empress, but then there are also enormous numbers of people who are around him, who are with him, who see him cry at the death of Bercier, for example, who notice the way that he goes out of his way to make sure that the drummer boys are warm and sitting by the campfire, who make sure that the sentries are given their glasses of wine before the marshals get them and so on. You know, it's basic leadership stuff. And he was very good at all of that. You know, the sort of just the sheer leadership lessons that he personified were ones that military leaders have followed ever since, really. I mean, he was one of the battles before Ulm. They needed to capture some heights in order to take Ulm. And he took off his own cloak to a wounded soldier and put it over him and said, if you bring me back this cloak after the battle, I will recognise you and I will give you the Légion d'honneur and a pension because you deserve it so much, because he'd actually seen him fight in the battle. And that's the kind of leadership that really does electrify, not just obviously the man who's fighting, but everybody else around who sort of knows that the emperor is sort of watching them. And that kind of leadership is sort of money can't buy type of leadership.
Memoirs of the Duke de Rovigo. The emperor came back in the evening along the whole line where the different regiments of the army had fought. It was already dark. He had recommended silence to all who accompanied him, that he might hear the cries of the wounded. He immediately went to the spot where they were, alighted himself, and ordered a glass of brandy to be given them from the canteen which always followed him. I was with him the whole of that night, during which he remained very late on the field of battle. The squadron of his escort passed the whole night upon it in taking the cloaks from the Russian dead for the purpose of covering the wounded with them. He himself ordered a large fire to be kindled near each of them, sent about for a muster master, and did not retire till he had arrived, and having left him a picket of his own escort, he enjoined him not to quit these wounded till they were all in the hospital. These brave men loaded him with blessings, which found the way to his heart much better than all the flatteries of courtiers. It was thus that he won the affection of his soldiers, who knew that when they suffered, it was not his fault, and therefore they never spared themselves in his service.
So tell us, how does Austerlitz end in terms of political ramifications? What does this mean for Napoleon and his conquest? And how does Francis I of Austria try to bring this to an end politically?
Well, he comes immediately after the defeat, either the day after or 2 days after, I forget, to make peace. And it is it's a swingeing peace on Austria. It costs Austria land. Once the Austrians are clearly making peace, then the Russians can't continue on. The Prussians didn't get involved until it was too late. And so they were the next for the chop, the next year in the Jena campaign in 1806. But it was a moment that the crushing of the Third Coalition was, you know, in many ways, Napoleon's finest hour. And you can see that when you go to Paris, if you go to the Louvre, the Petit Carousel has him and the figures of victory on this sort of small Arc de Triomphe, which has the story of the Third Coalition and some fantastic bas-relief marble figures that show the great moments in the campaign. And so it's sort of there forevermore to be glorified in the Napoleonic story. But he doesn't learn the lesson of the campaign, which is obviously how important it is to make peace afterwards. And there are, by 1813, he tries but fails to make peace because the Austrians and others, but particularly the Austrians under Metternich, have worked out that the only way to defeat him ultimately is to wear him down and refuse peace.
Well, Andrew, thank you so much for taking the time to discuss Napoleon's greatest victory. Tell us, where can people read more about this battle, about Napoleon?
Well, it's chapter 16 of my biography, Napoleon the Great, which is, of course, the first place that I would encourage anybody to read about it. It's quite an exciting chapter. Knowing that I was coming on this show, I reread it recently. And I must say, it's a real page turner, even if I say so myself. If you want a much more detailed blow-by-blow account, then you can always go to David Chandler. David, although that book was written in the 1960s, it's called The Campaigns of Napoleon, and it's a fabulous book. If you want something a bit more bite-sized, then there are any number of books about Napoleon and indeed about Austerlitz.
Wonderful. Andrew, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you very much indeed, James. I've much enjoyed it.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
And before you go, remember, as a Warfare listener, you get a special discount at History Hit. Subscribers get access to blissfully uninterrupted ad-free podcasts and thousands of hours of history documentaries. You've got everything from the American Revolution to my own documentaries like Traces of War, Weapons of War, and 24 Hours in Normandy, where I follow in the footsteps of the Green Howards on D-Day, from their beach landings to being awarded the Victoria Cross, and all the way through their first day where they made it 7 miles inland, further than any other British or American unit. So head over to historyhit.com/subscribe or follow the link in the show notes and use the code WARFARE to get 50% off your next 3 months. That's the code WARFARE to get 50% off. And if you're an Apple listener, you can subscribe for new ad-free episodes within the app. So give it a go. I know you're gonna love it.